Okay, we're going to get started. Our next speaker is Andrew Leaf. He's a hydrologist with the USGS Wisconsin Water Science Center. He works on hydrologic modeling studies throughout Wisconsin and the greater U.S. He has a bachelor's degree. We didn't list from of what? Geology and history, right?
Yep.
Geology and history from Gustavus Adolphus College, and a master's degree in hydrogeology and water resources management from University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also worked in the consulting field in Seattle prior to joining the USGS. So welcome, Andy.
Thanks, Evan, and thanks, everyone, for having me up here. It's great to be back in Minnesota. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors before I get started. Really, I'm just a messenger for this topic. They've done a lot of the legwork for it. Mike Feenan and Randy Hunt, who actually incidentally also came out of the Gustavus Geology Department. Mike's done a lot of work in parameter estimation and model uncertainty. He published one of the seminal papers on this topic in 2010. Randy's the co-author of the most recent update of the classic Applied Groundwater Modeling textbook. And then Jeremy White out of the Texas Water Science Center is a contributor to PEST++, which is the successor of PEST parameter estimation software. And he's also the author of the PI-EMU software for uncertainty analysis, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So a lot of this is their work too. So motivation, why do we model? At some point, we can only collect so much data, we need to answer a question, and maybe we need an answer that does a little bit better than arm waving. These are just some examples of questions we might have that are hydrologic in nature. There are many others. Models can provide a quantitative framework that allows us to fill in the gaps between our data with physics and give us some kind of answer that we can have hopefully a little bit of confidence in. Ideally, models can provide a framework to learn from additional data or data that we have to further reduce uncertainty in the questions we're trying to answer. But there's a lot of issues with modeling. This slide is kind of supposed to show what we're up against. Models are, no matter how complicated we make them, no matter how many processes we include, they're still greatly simplified compared to the real world. And usually for a given set of observation data, many different models can provide an acceptable level of fit. And so they're non-unique in that sense. This picture right here is from a 2010 paper. This study used a synthetic model to make a point. The prediction being shown is one of the hardest predictions to make, and that's travel time of a particle. Each one of these dots right here represents a calibrated model. There's over 4,000 points. Basically, they made up a hydraulic conductivity field that was known, and then there was a data set of heads and a flux target to calibrate that to. And they calibrated over 4,000 different models. And these are the predictions for the particle travel time that they got. On the x-axis here, this is the objective function. So going the lower values indicate a better fit to the observed data out to the end here where the fit isn't quite as good. The real travel time was 3,200 days. So that's way out on the limb. So there's several thousand models that had a better calibration, but we're wrong on the prediction. So model forecasts are always subject to uncertainty, and they're only as good as the data behind them, really. The right kind of data can help reduce uncertainty in a forecast, but how do we determine what data that is and how to collect it? So that's the goal of this talk, is to kind of showcase a way to get at that question. So I'm going to present a case study that we published a couple years ago from the Bad River Reservation in northern Wisconsin. And I'll talk a little bit about some uncertainty that goes into groundwater models, and then I'll give a brief background on the theory behind data worth, and then show how we applied it to this Bad River case study. And then I'll talk about some available tools if you want to try to apply this to a project you're working on. So this is located in northern Wisconsin. It's on the edge of the Mid-Continent Rift. This is the reservation right here. And the tribe was interested in knowing more about their groundwater resources, where the sources of water were, but also questions of how their resources might change The driving question at the time we started this study was this proposed mine in the Gogebic Range, which you can see right here. It's one of the largest taconite deposits in the lower 48. That project ended up going away, but it's a long-term thing that might happen if demand for iron goes back up. There's also concerns about industrial agriculture affecting the water resources and potentially climate change as well. This box right here shows the model area. We made a mod flow model that included groundwater flow and also base flow and streams. So some more info on the study area. Like I said, it's on the edge of the Mid-Continent Rift. There's old Archean rocks to the south. This is the Iron Range. And then we get into the Mid-Continent Rift deposits. There's a bunch of volcanics and then some sandstones. Needless to say, it's a complex natural system. I think some of the talks earlier this morning did a good job of showcasing some of the complexity that we see every day. This is just a diagram of some fracture sets in the Iron Range that influence fluid flow. So there's a lot of uncertainty. This is a cross-section through the model. You can see we know the land surface pretty well. That's easy to get. But as we go deeper, we know less and less. There's fractures. The angle of the bedding plane changes. So in the sandstones here, they're steeply dipping near the edge of the rift. But as you get out towards Lake Superior, there's more of a horizontal orientation. And we really have no idea where the bottom of the flow system is. At some depth, you get into brines, and they've encountered those in various wells that have been drilled, but those depths are all different, and so that surface is poorly understood. So in terms of uncertainty that goes into models, we might not know what the correct values are for the parameters that drive the model. We have errors in our measurements of the system state, so base flows and streams or water levels. That contribute to model error. And there's also defects in the model. We have to make simplifications to try to create a mathematical representation of the true system. So structural error, I don't want to say too much about this, but this is the bedrock surface. We do have a fair amount of data, including seismic lines and well construction reports, but there's some gaps in the data where we're basically just interpolating values. So you can think of the structural error as the difference between what we're putting into the model and what's actually there, and we really don't know what the nature of that is. Maybe an extreme example of structural error would be if you try to make a model of the whole state of Minnesota and you had one hydraulic conductivity value for it. Those differences across Minnesota would represent structural error. There are some tools that we can use to try to reduce this error. So this picture right here shows what are called pilot points. So we can estimate hydraulic conductivity at each one of these values, and we can interpolate between the pilot points within specified zones. So these zones right here are based on kind of grouped geologic units. So this gray area are the Mid-Continent Rift volcanics. This color right here are the sandstones. We have the Archean rocks, a thin zone for the Iron Range. And we also have some information on the distribution of hydraulic conductivity values in these units. So this is these data right here are from specific capacity tests that were taken when domestic wells were drilled. They're relatively low quality, but we have a lot of them, so we can analyze those. This shows estimated hydraulic conductivity values in the volcanic rocks. You can see it's a bimodal distribution, probably because some samples are more matrix or smaller fracture dominated, and others have larger fractures in them. And in the end, what we get is we get a map like this. So this is the hydraulic conductivity field in the calibrated model. And you can see that it's changed in some areas from like a mean value that we might put on the zone. So it's lower in this area, higher in this area. Perhaps better than using a uniform value in a zone, but we know the real world doesn't exactly look like this. So we can also use data to calibrate the model to hopefully improve the parameters that are in there so that we can make a more accurate forecast. So this figure right here just kind of shows how we can basically the observations, so measurements of head or base flow, for example, might contribute information to the model, which can then make a better forecast. And this happens through the calibration process. So I also want to make the point that observations can really be anything that the model can output, including ways we can process that data. So this is from a USGS study of the Trout Lake area from a couple years ago. So these are base flows in a creek, or actually stream flows, sorry, and they've been processed for different time periods. So these are daily values right here. These are mean annual values. We have mean monthly values for each month of the year. and we have mean values for each month. And these different process outputs contain different information about the system. So another key aspect of the calibration process is what we call the Jacobian matrix, and this basically provides us with a mapping from the model parameters to the observations or the model outputs, what the model can tell us about the system. This is basically just a formal sensitivity analysis. So if you look at the original Anderson and Wessner textbook from 92, they don't mention the Jacobian matrix, but they do talk about sensitivity analysis, and that's basically what this is. And this is a key aspect of model calibration, but this also really plays into uncertainty as well, and looking at uncertainty. Another way to look at model calibration is in the context of Bayes' theorem. So this basically, you can think of this probabilistically. So we have our parameters such as hydraulic conductivity, and we have a sense just like the distribution I showed of values for the volcanics a few slides back of how they might be distributed. So if we want to estimate a value, we think it's here, but it might range from -5 to 15, for example. This term right here is called the likelihood function. So we can think of this as what we learned from the calibration. So here we get a narrow distribution of what we think the hydraulic conductivity values might be. And if we combine the two, we get something that's in between, but that's hopefully narrower, meaning we learned something. So just about every modeling report you read will have a plot like this. This kind of illustrates how we compare output from the model to real-world values. So this is a fit of head measurements. And you can see it looks very good because that's exactly what the parameter estimation software we use is designed to do. This is the same thing, just plotted on a map. So the bigger circles are where we're further away from our observed values, and the smaller circles are where the model matches them pretty well. And again, going back to the example of the pilot points, really what we're doing in calibration is we're adjusting the parameter values to improve the fit to the data, but hopefully still keeping them in line with what we think we know about the geology of the system. What does that look like for the model forecast? This graph is from a different USGS study. This is actually from Texas. This is looking at dissolved solids concentrations in wells during a drought. It's a repeat of this drought they experienced down there between 1950 and 1956. The gray bars are basically the simulated concentrations using just the prior parameter uncertainties. So what was known about the system before calibration based on aquifer test data, geologic knowledge, things like that. The purple bars here are uncertainties in dissolved solid concentration after calibration. So you can see they're all reduced. And so this is an example of how calibration can reduce uncertainty. But there's limits to what it can do. So this is back to the Bad River project here. These maps right here show what we call parameter identifiability. And without going into too much detail, basically it's kind of a semi-quantitative measure of how much our model input parameters are constrained by the observation data. So the big circles indicate identifiability values of 1. So that means those parameters can be estimated from the observations. The small circles, which you can't even see, mean there's basically no observation data in these areas to constrain the parameters. And so in those cases, we're kind of stuck with our prior values that we started with. You can see here, this is horizontal hydraulic conductivity in the bedrock. Generally, it's pretty good because these are where most of the wells are located. This is in the deep sandstone aquifer. And in the southern part, it's in fractured crystalline bedrock. On the right here, we have vertical hydraulic conductivity. And the model does a much poorer job with that, or our observations, I should say, do a much poorer job constraining that. We really don't know much about vertical hydraulic conductivity. Other kinds of data, perhaps, you know, like tracer tests, looking at recharge in more detail could help us get at this, possibly. And so if we're going to make a prediction, we might have less confidence in the areas with less identifiability. So on to data worth. So going back to Bayes' theorem, again, we're talking about this process of trying to improve inputs to the model from what we started with using observation data to hopefully narrow our uncertainty about those inputs. The problem with Bayes' theorem is that to apply it rigorously to groundwater models requires a lot of computational effort, And so for a lot of situations, it's just unpractical. But it turns out we can make some assumptions. For example, we can assume that there's a linear relationship between the model parameters and the observations. So regardless of what the actual values we put into the model are, if we change a parameter, we can expect a similar output in the observations. The other assumption is that the uncertainty is roughly Gaussian, so that it's normally distributed about what we think the mean values are. So again, this gets back to the Jacobian matrix. These are those linear relationships. So with a given change in a single parameter, we might expect the same change in an observation. And these are all independent of the actual values of the parameters themselves. So with those assumptions in Bayes' theorem, you can derive this equation called Schur's complement. And we are getting into the weeds a bit here, but I think that we have to do this to understand this topic. Hopefully we can find a trail at some point in this case study. So there's this term right here, what we knew. This is the prior uncertainty. And this is what this is a covariance matrix. So it's the size of it is the number of parameters squared in the model. And the diagonal elements going down the middle are uncertainties in those parameters. So we can estimate those from things like t-guess, where we look at specific capacity tests and wells, come up with a distribution or a 95% confidence interval for each parameter, and put that into this prior matrix. This term right here basically approximates the calibration process. So it includes the uncertainty that we originally had in the parameters. It includes the sensitivities, which are encapsulated in the Jacobian here. And then this term right here represents measurement uncertainty. So if we have a water level from a random well construction report, what do we think the uncertainty about that water level is? That's what goes into this term. And this is also a covariance matrix, so it's the number of observations by the number of observations. And again, there's diagonal terms that represent the uncertainty, and then if we have off-diagonal terms, those might represent correlation between observations, which we usually don't have a good idea about starting out. And we get this posterior covariance matrix. And again, this is another figure from that Texas study. This shows a normal distribution for the prior uncertainty, and this is probably pretty hard to see right here. Oh, it's not so bad on the screen, but you can see how that is narrowed through this through Schur's complement. And this minus term right here basically shows that we're subtracting uncertainty through the second term. So how do we translate that into model forecasts? All we need is this term y right here, and this is basically the same as a Jacobian. It's the sensitivity of a forecast, so a model prediction of a water level or a base flow in stream, or it could be a particle travel time, and that's with respect to each parameter. So we change each parameter, how much does the forecast change? So we just multiply that term by our covariance matrix, and we get a forecast uncertainty. So going back to the Texas study again, this basically shows what Schur's complement does to uncertainty. In this case, reducing the uncertainty in the simulated dissolved solids concentrations in the wells with a drought. So now we're almost to data worth. This is basically just a way to normalize the reduction in uncertainty so we can compare between different new observations. So we take the forecast uncertainty that we got from the model calibration. We basically run the calibration with one additional observation. And we could put this anywhere. This is just somewhere we might want to drill a well. And again, we're subtracting that off to get a difference. And we're normalizing by the original forecast uncertainty. And so we get values from 0, which basically means that the new observation has no effect on the forecast, to 1, which would mean that it eliminated all uncertainty in the forecast. So going back to this figure again, there's three different types of data worth we could look at. So the most direct type of data worth is to look at the model parameters themselves. So look at how we could measure hydraulic conductivity better, for example. And that would narrow our uncertainty in those parameters directly and hopefully improve the forecast. We could also, like I showed before, we could add a new observation, or we could remove an existing observation. This third kind is less common, although in general this is a fairly new technique that isn't super widely implemented yet. So I'm going to show how we did this for the Bad River study. The goal here was to look at new monitoring well locations and look at how those could improve forecasts of water levels and base flows under the condition of a dewatering stress from this mine. So going through the terms, our prior uncertainty we got from these TGS values, and so really these just represent a 95% confidence interval in log space for these parameters. And in general, the volcanic units had a wider range of uncertainty, probably because of fractures. The sandstones were a little bit better. Whoops. And so this is basically how we populated this term in Schur's complement. There's also the measurement uncertainty. All of observations came from well construction reports, the National Water Information System, records from the tribe, and we just assign uncertainty values to all those observations. So some of our wells, we had time series data for our multiple measurements. Those we know the best. We're probably more limited by the elevation of the well or seasonal variation. Other wells we don't know quite as well. And likewise, similar to stream flows, some stream flows were taken from single measurements we took. Others were from gauges with continuous data. And again, this information we already had to basically put into the calibration process for the model anyways. This is stuff that PEST needs to do the weighting, and so we already had this. So all these points right here show potential forecasts. So the blue triangles are base flow predictions, and the red circles are predictions of water levels. This feature right here is the mine pit as it was proposed. So it's about 4.5 miles long and 0.5 mile wide and 800 feet deep. So we basically put those into the model and set that as a boundary condition to simulate the dewatering effects. Each one of these little points right here that are harder to see represents a potential new monitoring well. So there's 2,700 of these, and we looked at each one of these points for how much it could reduce the forecast uncertainty. So basically, to do this, we calculated the Jacobian using the parameters from the calibrated model, and we added the new monitoring wells to this, to PEST, basically, so we could get sensitivities for them. And then, likewise, we added the predictions as well. And we did another run with the predictions with this dewatering condition in place to try to simulate this future condition. So this is the workflow. This is kind of in the weeds, but I mean, it was a fair amount of work to do this. And this kind of gets into tools, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Newer tools are starting to reduce the amount of work you have to do for this kind of analysis. So here's the results. These are all in the report right here, which you can find online. So this shows, the prediction here is groundwater levels near this lake that's south of the mine. So in this case, we have data worth here. We've calculated it for each one of these new observation points, and then we've contoured it. The high values of 1 would be orange, and then low values are blue in the background here. And you can see basically what this is telling us is we want to have an observation well between the lake and the mine, which pretty much makes sense. A lot of this can be pretty intuitive. This is for base flow in the Tyler Forks River, just to the east of the mine, right on the edge of the mine pit. And again, it's kind of similar. I mean, really, to know how much the water level is going to drop as a result of the mine, we want to monitor near the mine. That makes sense. There's also a small cloud right here between the Tyler Forks and Potato Rivers. And this tells us that it's also useful to monitor near hydrologic divides. Observations there can give us a sense of which way the water is going to go between the two streams. And with that knowledge, that improves what we can predict for base flow. This is an observation that's nowhere near the mine. This is off in left field, literally. And this has very strong data worth. Again, it's near a hydrologic divide with another stream. And part of the reason it's strong is because we don't have a lot of observations in this area. And so there's a lot to be gained by putting in a new well here if we cared about flow in Springbrook Creek. This one's the opposite. This is near the lake at the fish hatchery. And we have a lot of wells already in this area on the reservation, so we know the water levels pretty well there. And it's near the lake. The lake is a pretty solid boundary condition that's not going to change much. And so really by adding a well here, we don't gain much information. So using a parameterization scheme like the pilot points that allows hydraulic connectivity to vary across space is really important for this kind of analysis. We also ran the analysis with an analytic element model of the area. And this used constant zones, so where hydraulic connectivity was constant for the whole zone. And the results we got with the analytic element model were really diffuse. So you can see here the green pretty much fills this entire zone. Because there's only one place in this whole zone for information from a new observation to go. And so it's hard to really, it's hard for the model to really learn much in that case. So available tools. So in the past, this is the kind of workflow you had to go through to do this analysis, and that's probably one of the reasons why it hasn't been done as much. Some new software is really making improvements in this. So PEST++, it's a USGS program. It's still actively being developed, but it's meant to be the successor to PEST. And it provides forecast uncertainty as part of the standard output when you calibrate the model. And so that can be really useful. It can actually be used to design, basically help you set up the calibration to minimize that uncertainty from the start. And then it also has a lot of other analyses that are built in, and it's actively being added to. There's also another program called PyEmu. This is a Python interface, and this is kind of more for exploratory analysis. And again, it's pretty easy. This just shows some code you would need to look at forecast uncertainty. So here we're just reading in a Jacobian file that contains the Jacobian matrix from a PEST run. And with a single command, we can basically get all the forecast uncertainties, both before calibration and after calibration, as well as the percent reduction. So we've got the data worth right there. PyEmu is also being actively developed. There's a lot of great things you can do with it. Because it's in Python, you can take advantage of all the other Python libraries. So Pandas, for example, which is really great for working with time series. FlowPy, which interfaces with ModFlow. This figure right here was made using FlowPy. This is for another kind of a test model. And what this shows is a sequential computation of data worth. So zero right here is the most valuable observation. But then assuming we've already included zero, what's the next most valuable? So that's something that wasn't easy to do before, but it's been implemented in PyEmu. And so you can see going all the way out to 9 new observations, you can see the locations kind of jump around as to what the next most valuable observation is. And PyEmu, it has a lot of other functionality too. It can help you set up a PEST run. It can use this linear analysis technique to do sampling for a Monte Carlo run, which can be a really useful way to look at uncertainty in a more detailed way. And development's ongoing, so there's new features being added all the time. So conclusions, this method has a lot of potential, I think, with limited resources to really optimize what kind of data we collect. It doesn't require a calibrated model, so it can be done early on in a study to look at what data would be best to collect before the budget's been expended. A lot of the information that's needed is already information you need anyways to set up a calibration run with PEST. There's new tools that are reducing the barrier to entry and expanding what we can do with it. And the way you set up the model is important. Another point is that different forecasts are sensitive to different data. So depending on what you want the model to do, you might get a different answer for data worth. That's a very important point. Like, one model can't do every single forecast equally. And then another thing is this linear assumption can't account for things like streams drying up. And so actually some of the forecasts we tried to make with the mine dewatering, we couldn't get any results for because the streams are dry. So that's one limitation of this technique. So here are some key references if you'd like to know more. This is the revised edition, the most recent edition of Applied Groundwater Modeling. PyEmu, there's a paper on it, as well as the GitHub site has a lot of information, including code tutorials and how to do some of these analyses with it. And then John Doherty actually also has, he's the author of PEST, he's got this really great tutorial on the PEST homepage. It is using his utilities, there's a lot of moving pieces involved, but in terms of the concepts, I think he does a good job of explaining it. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Thanks.
I have one.
Sure.
So you have a data worth that says hydraulic connectivity in an area is most important. But how could you tease out that it might really be the thickness of that unit is really what you need to know, because the transmissivity is kind of related to the thickness and the K combined.
Yeah, that's a good point. At some level, I mean, oftentimes you're just looking at transmissivity anyways with a model, but a lot of it's in how you set everything up. Usually we don't look at thickness, because to do it with data worth, you have to have a way for, you have to have a way to compute the sensitivity. So you'd have to have a way for PEST to systematically adjust that thickness at every point so you can find out where it matters. It's certainly possible to do it, but it's a lot of work. The short answer is, it wouldn't be the easiest thing to do, but I guess it can, at least either way, your focus is guided, is kind of guided to that area.
Sure.
So when you're initially setting up the model with the data worth analysis in mind, what considerations would you make for runtime model size that might be different from just a standard calibration?
The nice thing about this linear analysis, which I didn't mention, is that it doesn't require that many runs. It can be as few runs as the number of parameters. If you want to do a second run under some future condition, then it might be two runs per parameter. So that's relatively little compared to calibrating the model. So that's not as much of a concern. Probably the biggest is giving the model flexibility to absorb new data. So if you only have a few parameters, the model is going to be really overdetermined, and new data is not going to really make a difference in the values you estimate for those. In that case, most of your error is transferred to basically how the parameters don't represent the real world. And that error is really hard to get at. So I'd say, flexible parameterization is really important too.
I have one more. Have you tried to take the data worth and associate it with like a cost model? So, you know, different types of data associated with the cost to kind of get a financial analysis of what data might give you the most bang for your buck?
We have not tried to do that, but you certainly could. I mean, in this case, we kind of assume you could put a monitoring well everywhere, which is probably not a good assumption, because it's actually a horrible assumption, because this area, I mean, there's wetlands everywhere. So a lot of these places, I guess you could drill them in the winter probably, but the cost goes up, and that would be a really good thing to look at.
All right, thank you.